again, not trying to come to terms with the most basic, simple things about the Vietnam War. Why did the Vietnamese fight the greatest power in the world, and how could they defeat them? And that's the big thing about Vietnam. So they spend a lot of time rewriting history and distorting it because it serves a purpose of laying the groundwork for the next awful imperial adventure that this government does. They spent 15 years trying to undo the Vietnam War so they could launch a war in Iraq, and look at the disastrous consequences with that.
That's Joe Allen, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Joe Allen on Vietnam. All imperial systems attempt to reinvent the past, engineer history to suit their needs. The United States is no different. Vietnam is a perfect example. A war of aggression was transformed into a conflict. It was tragic and a mistake. At the other end of the spectrum, the so-called liberal Washington Post called the war a just cause. That's the range of opinion in describing one of the major atrocities of the 20th century. The sheer savagery of the U.S. attack is largely forgotten. The war on Vietnam, later extended to Laos and Cambodia, included mass murder from the air and ferocious assaults on the ground. Millions were killed. About the agony and suffering of the victims, virtually nothing. Reparations, apologies, no way. And the architects of destruction, the war criminals, held accountable, trials, jail time, then, as now, nothing. This classic from the AR archives marks the 50th anniversary of the My Lai massacre. Historian Jonathan Schell wrote that My Lai had come to be the rule and not the exception in our conduct of the war. To talk about Vietnam is Joe Allen. Joe Allen is a contributor to the International Socialist Review and an activist in peace and justice movements. He's the author of Vietnam, The Last War the U.S. Lost. He spoke at Harold Washington College in Chicago. And now, Joe Allen.
I thought I'd start off by reading something from the introduction that can give people an idea of why I think the Vietnam War is still worth discussing today, but also some idea of its importance for people then. And this is in the introduction to my book. For the generation of Americans who came of age in the three decades since the last U.S. troops left Vietnam, the history of the war is practically forgotten. The motivation that drove the United States to launch one of the most destructive wars of the 20th century, and the reasons that millions of ordinary Americans came to actively oppose it, are also largely forgotten or distorted. President Lyndon Johnson once described Vietnam in his own particularly racist and vulgar way as a, quote, raggedy-ass, fourth-rate country, end of quote. How such a country could defeat the most powerful government in the world had to be hidden from both the oppressed of the world and the American people. This is the job of the popular media, establishment historians, and their friends in Hollywood. It is one of the great ironies of American history that one can watch many of the war and Vietnam-related films produced by Hollywood, with a few notable exceptions, and actually know less about the war than before walking into the theater to see them. History, it is said, is written by the victor. In the case of Vietnam, history is still being written or rewritten, at least outside of Vietnam, by the loser that still remains the dominant economic and military power in the world today. So I might give people some idea of why I wrote the book on Vietnam and why it's very important to continue to talk about these days. A friend of mine asked me a long time ago, why did you write a book on Vietnam? And I said, I never really planned to write one. The reason why I ended up doing it was because of the events following 9/11, or after the events of that terrible day, it was very clear that the Bush administration wanted to use those tragic events to do something else than simply bring to justice the people who had committed those crimes. They wanted to use it to extend their global power and military power around the globe, particularly in the Middle East. And for many people at that moment after 9/11, there was this sort of idea that the United States was the most invincible power in the world, that it could simply impose its will anywhere in the world, that it was a benign power, that it always had the best motivations, it was trying to free people, it was trying to free people in order to have democracy and so forth and so on. And many people have heard these things time and time and time again. And people should ask me questions about some of that stuff and its relevance today. But when the wars began, first in Afghanistan and then the invasion of Iraq, I decided to start writing about Vietnam because, like I said in the introduction, the issues have been largely forgotten or distorted. I mean, I take for granted that everybody in this room has been to college at least for a few years, and I would assume that nobody in this class here has ever taken a course on the Vietnam War. Am I correct in that? That in most history courses, Vietnam is a very tiny footnote. I was in college in the late 1970s and early 1980s at UMass Boston, where I was actually very lucky to actually have a teacher who actually taught an entire course on the Vietnam War. And now, nearly 30 years later, I couldn't tell you a major university where one course is taught. I believe down in Champaign, Urbana, there's actually a professor who teaches a course on the Vietnam War. And that isn't an accident. One of the things that, like I said in the introduction, is how could one of the poorest countries in the world defeat the most powerful and richest country in the world? It wasn't a secret at the time, but it had to be distorted and rewritten. For those of us who were, adults and could go to movies in the 1980s, in particular television, it was a terrible time when you just saw many films. During the Vietnam War, for example, there was only one film made about the Vietnam War. It was this really bad film called The Green Berets with John Wayne. I hope nobody else has ever seen it. My grandmother took me to it when I was 7 years old. But Hollywood, for the most part, didn't do anything during the war itself. After the war, and particularly the 1980s, it was one film after another, and with a handful of exceptions. Most of them were dreadful. They portrayed the United States as the victim in the Vietnam War, that American prisoners were systematically tortured, that Vietnam was never explained as a people with their own history. They were just this kind of unexplainable, awful thing that happened to the United States. And, of course, I think the issues of Vietnam are very relevant today because soon after the United States invaded Iraq and an insurgency began against the first government that was imposed by the United States there, the question of is this the next Vietnam began to be talked about actively in the media. And probably people remember these things. And one after another, people began to say, is this like the Vietnam War? So that's kind of why I decided to write some articles, and articles turned into a book, and that's how I ended up becoming an author of a book on Vietnam. And to describe America as an empire may seem to be an odd thing, but I think most people have come to accept the fact that here's a country that has over 300 military bases around the world. It means that there are more American military bases around the world than there are actually countries now. Its corporations dominate large sections of the world economy, and particularly in the Middle East. It's American oil companies that dominate oil, and I think we all know that the wars in the Middle East are all about oil. There's no dispute about that, right, to this very day. But then the question becomes, how is it that the United States can be stopped pursuing these aggressive policies? If you look at Iraq and Afghanistan, since the beginning of the Iraq War, nearly 1 million Iraqis have died as a result of the American war. And all the reports about Afghanistan are just people being slaughtered by the tens of thousands by the American military presence. And this is why, the issue of Vietnam is still very important, because it remains the single greatest defeat that the United States ever suffered. And it was a defeat that came about because, as the great historian Howard Zinn said, because the U.S. was defeated both in the Mekong Delta, which is the agricultural region of Vietnam, and it was defeated in the Mississippi Valley, that is, in the heart of the United States, because millions of Americans came to oppose this war and to oppose American foreign policy in general. There's a discussion these days about closing down the awful American torture camps in Guantanamo Bay. But, you'll never find a broadcast where anybody says, why is it that the United States has an American military base in a nominally communist country? It's just naturally assumed that the United States can have bases all over the world, but nobody has bases here, right? I mean, if you walked out the door tomorrow morning and there was a Serbian military base on Lake in Wabash, you'd think that would be pretty strange, right? So there's all sorts of assumptions about what the United States can do and can't do that are up for discussion these days. Now, when it comes to the issue of Vietnam, there's two questions usually a lot of activists, well, one big question that answered in two part about why was the war different then from it is now, particularly the anti-war movement in this country, and why ultimately was the U.S. defeated in the Vietnam War. Well, I think you got to look at two things, two important movements that came together in the 1960s that had a profound effect on tens of millions of people around the world. One is the Vietnamese struggle for national independence. You know, you can watch all the movies on Vietnam, and they never are told from the perspective of the Vietnamese. Now, that's like doing a history of the civil rights movement in the United States, and black people play no role in it, right? It's pretty strange. You know, it would be a pretty strange history if that was done that way. But that's just assumed by Hollywood. You know, you do films on Vietnam, but the Vietnamese don't exist in them. And the other is the importance, really, of the civil rights and black power movement in this country, because one of the things that was very important to the creation of a mass anti-war movement in this country was the civil rights and black power movement. One of the great hidden aspects of the 1960s that people just are not taught at all in school these days is how right from the very beginning of the war was key leaders of the civil rights movement opposed what the United States was doing in the Vietnam War. Now, let's just talk about the Vietnamese for a second. Now, there's a great documentary called Hearts and Minds. Has anybody ever seen it? Right? There's one person who says it. It won the documentary in 1975 for the best documentary that year, and it produced a fistfight between Bob Hope and Frank Sinatra off stage, because when they won the Academy Award for the documentary, they read a congratulatory telegram from the North Vietnamese government, and this outraged the Oscars. And those are the Oscars I like, as opposed to the staid Oscars that we see too much of the time. And in that documentary, there's an interview with a Vietnamese Catholic priest named Father Chan Tin, who's still alive and lives in Vietnam. And he says in there, in a very straightforward way, we fought against the Chinese for 1,000 years, we fought against the French for 100 years, and beginning in the 1950s, we fought against the Americans who brought their huge army to this country and started committing genocide to our people. And I think that that's a very short answer to a much longer question about the Vietnamese struggle. The person who is the most identified with the struggle for Vietnamese independence is a man who later became known as Ho Chi Minh, who became leader of the communist movement in Vietnam. He did not start out as a Marxist or a communist. He started out as somebody living in exile in Paris. And after the First World War was over, and where they were having the negotiations about what the world would look like after the First World War at Versailles, he wrote the first of letters to Woodrow Wilson, the American president, who proclaimed that America supported the right of nations to self-determination. And Ho Chi Minh's letter very simply asked that the United States government support the Vietnamese right to have their own country. His letter was ignored, and he would write letters to all American presidents from until the day he died in 1969, asking all American presidents to recognize Vietnamese independence. That's not in any of the Rambo films. During the Second World War, Ho Chi Minh returned to Vietnam and organized a movement for national independence. It was occupied by the Japanese and by the French. They collaborated both in exploiting the country. And in 1945, after the defeat of the Japanese and the Viet Minh took control of the country, in Hanoi, the capital city, Ho Chi Minh declared the independence of Vietnam in front of 200,000 people. And he began his declaration of independence by saying, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and that they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. Among those rights are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." And we all know those words because they're the opening lines of the Communist Manifesto, right? Right. Now, also during the Second World War, Ho Chi Minh was an ally of the United States government, and they fought the Japanese together. But after the war, the United States supported France in reconquering the country. And after a 9-year bloody war, Vietnam had defeated the French, and the second effort at Vietnam trying to be free was thought to be at hand. However, the United States intervened at that point and partitioned the country illegally and set up a military dictatorship in the South. But the Vietnamese had had a long struggle for freedom, and they weren't about to give it up. And so from the early 60s onward until 1965, a new movement began in what was called South Vietnam. For the Vietnamese, there's only one Vietnam. North and South are creations of the Americans. A very powerful movement arose against the American-backed dictators in Saigon. In order to prevent this movement from coming to power and reunifying the country, the United States sent its huge army to Vietnam in 1965. People should remember that the person who did this was Lyndon Johnson, and he ran for president in 1964 pledging peace and that he would not send American boys to fight in Vietnam. So remember the pledges of politicians. They're meant to be broken, right? And the Americans brought to war an incredibly destructive war to Vietnam. You know, the one thing about most of the films on Vietnam is that you'll get no sense of how destructive the war itself was. Sometimes when you watch documentaries, you'll get a little glimpse of it all. But here's something that I wrote about just one aspect of the American war in Vietnam. And this was one of the major reasons that Americans came to oppose the war very quickly in large numbers. And people around the world did too. The United States dropped more than 1 million tons of bombs on North Vietnam and more than 4 million tons on the South. Now, the South is the ally, so don't be an ally of the United States. Stunningly, the amount of bombs dropped by the United States on South Vietnam in the air war alone, that's not with artillery, that's just the bombings by B-52s and other planes, was double the tonnage it used in all of the Second World War. I mean, this gives you some incredible idea of how destructive the war was that the Americans brought there. Life was made unbearable in the South Vietnamese countryside. Well, it was probably an underestimate. The U.S. Senate Subcommittee on Refugees reported that the civilian casualties at more than 400,000 dead, 900,000 wounded, and 6.4 million refugees by 1971. This is a country of 27 million people. Think of the proportions here. It concluded, quote, that there is hardly a family in South Vietnam that has not suffered a death, injury, or the anguish of abandoning an ancient homestead. And that isn't the end of the horrors. The Americans brought all sorts of things to Vietnam that just killed, maimed millions. The most, you know, they created what were called free fire zones. They would just declare whole areas of the country, places where, get out because we're just going to bomb it to death. They sprayed the countryside with herbicides to destroy the foliage. The most notorious of them was a herbicide called Agent Orange that was laced with the cancer-causing dioxin. It caused millions and millions of deaths and deformities of Vietnamese civilians, particularly children, and it boomeranged back on tens of thousands of American combat soldiers who would later die of cancer or their kids would be deformed. My uncle would later die from his exposure to Agent Orange when he was a Marine in Vietnam. He died 30 years after the war officially ended for him. So that's one big aspect of why the Vietnam War was important, that the Vietnamese national struggle was important, the horror of the war that was brought there. But the other component to the why the anti-war movement in this country came to embrace millions of people, remember the largest demonstrations in American history really up until the immigrant rights demonstrations a couple of years ago were directed at ending the war in Vietnam. By the end of the 1960s, there were days of moratorium and marches that involved millions of people across the country. Again, you never see this in any of the history books. And a key component of reason why those demonstrations were so big was the civil rights and black power movement. Now, one of the reasons why that's important is because, you know, the civil rights movement really begins with Martin Luther King and the Montgomery bus boycott in the mid-1950s, which was a successful defeat of Jim Crow there. And what it does is not only it ignites a movement of African Americans and their supporters to end the old Jim Crow system, but it brings to the end the period of McCarthyism, where all political dissent in the country was literally squashed. People were terrified to be seen as anything except a mainstream conservative in American life. And the war, and during the course of the Vietnam War, millions of African Americans actually came to identify with the struggle of the Vietnamese. I mean, that's not talked about at all on days celebrating Black History Month or Martin Luther King's birthday. But let me give you one quote from somebody I think you've heard of. You know, everybody's heard of Muhammad Ali, right? Right? He's not an obscure figure. In the mid-1960s, Muhammad Ali, of course, became the world heavyweight champion, changed, you know, his given name was Cassius Clay. He called himself Muhammad Ali and declared his allegiance to the Nation of Islam. He also, very importantly, when he was called up for the draft, refused to go and was interviewed and was asked, why are you not going to go join the American military? And he says, well, I have no quarrel with the Viet Cong. Now, people heard it slightly differently, but that's the actual quote itself. Sometimes Ali's opposition to the war is denigrated by sports historians and writers. And I think that to give you a real sense of not only how important the civil rights and Black Power movement were important in terms of getting the anti-war movement going, but also in terms of how it was its ongoing inspiration during this entire time and how millions of African Americans actually began to identify with the Vietnamese. Here's a little bit of a longer quote from Muhammad Ali that I think will give people some sense of the movement and its time. This is what he said in 1967 when he was facing 5 years in prison. "Why should they ask me to put on a uniform and go 10,000 miles from home and drop bullets and bombs on the brown people in Vietnam while the so-called Negro people in Louisville," that was his hometown, "are treated like dogs and denied simple human rights? No, I am not going 10,000 miles from home to help murder and burn another poor nation simply to continue the domination of the white slave masters over the darker people of the world. This is the day when such evils must come to an end. I have been warned to take such a stand would cost me millions of dollars. But I have said it once, and I will say it again, that the real enemy of my people is here. I will not disgrace myself, my religion, or my people by becoming a tool to enslave those who are fighting for their own justice, freedom, and equality. If I thought the war was going to bring freedom and equality to 22 million of my people, they wouldn't have to draft me. I'd join tomorrow. I have nothing to lose for standing up for my beliefs, so I'll go to jail. So what? We've been in jail for 400 years. Now, you don't see those on the Nike commercials, do you? Right? And that's part of the hidden history of the 1960s, which many people assume that they actually know quite a lot about. But that's probably the first time you ever heard that quote from Muhammad Ali, right? One of the things that was also important is that not only was Ali important as a world figure, because, you know, when he was barred from boxing, he traveled the globe actually speaking out against the war in Vietnam. And, you know, people would just rally all around him wherever he would go and speak. You know, people demonstrated publicly from cities as distant as Cairo to Jakarta in support of Ali and his opposition to the war and his refusal to join it. The other person who was very important, and this is recognized by most histories in terms of turning an even larger number of people against the Vietnam War, was Martin Luther King. Now, Martin Luther King was still in many ways in 1967 seen by many African Americans as really the leader of their community around a whole series of issues. And he gave a very famous speech in April 1967, literally a year before he was murdered, against the war in Vietnam. And I would encourage everybody who can to really download the speech and read it for yourselves, because there's a very modern and eerie quality to the speech itself, which makes it very relevant to this very day. And here's just a few things that King said. So, "A few years ago, there was a shining moment. It seemed as if there was a real promise of hope for the poor." Now, this is 1967. He's not talking about the Reagan era, right? This is 1967 giving this speech. "Both black and white through the poverty program. Then came the build-up in Vietnam. And I watched the program broken and eviscerated, as if it was some idle plaything of a society gone mad on war. So I was increasingly compelled to see the war as an enemy of the poor and attack it as such. We were taking the young black men who had been crippled by our society and sending them 8,000 miles away to guarantee liberties in Southeast Asia, which they had not found in Southwest Georgia or East Harlem. So we have been repeatedly faced with the cruel irony of watching Negro and white boys on TV screens as they kill and die together for a nation that has been unable to seat them together in the same schools. As I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. But they ask, what about Vietnam? Their questions hit home, and I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government." Now, you don't see that displayed by McDonald's on Martin Luther King's birthday, do you? Now, King ended this speech in a way that I think is also quite unique and gives people a flavor for how important people like Ali and King were in terms of motivating opposition to the war in Vietnam. He ended it by calling for what he called a revolution in values. "I am convinced that if we are to get on the right side of the world revolution," you don't hear preachers talking like that these days, right? "we as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. A true revolution of values would soon cause us to question the fairness and justice of our past and present policies. These are revolutionary times. All over the globe, men and women are revolting against the old systems of exploitation and oppression. Now let us begin, now let us rededicate ourselves to the long and bitter but beautiful struggle for a new world. And I think that gives people a kind of sense of the black movement and the anti-war movement. Now what does all this mean for us today? Is this just nice history that, you know, you can read about but isn't relevant to people's lives? And I think a lot of this is very, very relevant to a lot of the issues that we face today in the United States. After all, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are approaching $1 trillion over the last couple of years. The regular U.S. military budget is approaching $600 billion a year. That's aside from all the supplementary budgets that go. And at the same time, we see everything around us just crumbling. I've lived here for 15 years in Chicago. This place is called the city that works. I don't know. And nothing works around here, right? I mean, the buses, the trains, nothing works, right? And, of course, with the recent bailout of Wall Street, you know, there always seems to be huge amounts of cash for the politically connected. They just gave $30 billion to Citibank today. $30 billion could do a lot for Chicago. And I think that, you know, one of the lessons when you look back upon the struggle against the Vietnam War is, one is the supporting the people who don't want the Americans in their countries, whether it be in Iraq and Afghanistan, is very important. The other is the importance is the struggle against racism and oppression here. And I think the last one is the importance of really trying to, is the importance of struggle and activism itself, because of the great lessons of the 60s and 70s was, if you don't fight, things can get a lot worse, but also if you fight, you really can change things. And I think that's the great lesson of Vietnam and our movement here. And if people have any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them for you. Thank you.
I was traveling around Vietnam about, 10 years ago, something like that, and incredibly struck by a lot of Westerners, mainly Americans, and young folks who had traveled to Vietnam to sort of check out the war camps and the booby traps. They were just romanticizing the war, you know, and it was shocking and disgusting, and the museums, of course, in Vietnam are very clear about whom they were faulting, you know, and they actually showed lots of disturbing pictures and fetuses in jars that had been affected by Agent Orange and stuff like that. And, you know, I was violently sick. It was very difficult for me to be there as an American. But I was wondering what you could say about the fact that there is this sort of romantic idea about that war. Is it just, you know, the fault of the media or Hollywood or, you know, there doesn't seem to be any sort of feeling of guilt, you know, that accompanies other countries such as Germans, you know, they go visit their concentration camps and stuff like that. And what can be done about that to combat that? I think, one other thing I wanted to add is, you know, in the films that we see about Vietnam, you know, they have these smashing soundtracks and there's this lovely, you know, wonderful music that's in the background and everyone's sort of, you know, smoking marijuana and cigarettes and they seem to be having a grand old time, you know.
Well, music was important in the 60s because they had great music, right? But, you know, it's always a tendency among the way that they try to massage the past is that you reduce important historical events to simply just culture or fashion or music. And you sort of take the sort of really the issues of politics and struggle out of that stuff. I mean, you can't attribute to why Motown was so great without understanding the civil rights movement and stuff like that.
You're listening to Joe Allen on Vietnam, a classic from the AR archives. This is Independent Alternative Radio.
But I think in the films about Vietnam is that, you know, there's some really great films about Vietnam. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I think that, you know, there's a remade version of Apocalypse Now called Apocalypse Now Redux, as we would crude Americans would say, and that was released just before the 9/11. That's actually a very good history, because the very good movie, because the one that was released in 1979 by Francis Ford Coppola, who made a lot of great movies, you know, The Godfather and a bunch of The Conversation, a bunch of great films, was not a very good film. It was edited badly. It was pretty reactionary. And the funny thing is, if you see the film that he wanted to make, which was released earlier in the decade, it's actually a very good film. It's got good history to it, good politics. It's, you know, you learn something about the war. Too much of the time when you just watch films, they're just outright lies or just trivialize things. So there's, you know, there's films like The Hanoi Hilton, which is supposed to be about American prisoners of war in North Vietnam. And there's a scene in one of them where American prisoners are tortured because they don't want to meet with American anti-war activists. It's sort of a thinly disguised attack on Jane Fonda. No such thing ever happened. Part of that is because it was part of an effort in the 1980s in particular to sort of rehabilitate the right of the United States to intervene anywhere it wanted to in the world, whether it had the support of the American population or not. I mean, most of this is identified with the Reagan years, but it's more broader than that. There's a, you know, there's a French film called Indochine, which is a very good film. You know, there's, you know, Platoon has its weaknesses, but it's better than most. One of the things I think that was, it's kind of underestimated is, you know, the monument to the Vietnam War in Washington is actually a very moving monument, and people who haven't seen it should, because in many ways it reflects the impact of the anti-war movement, because it's the most unwarlike monument to a war that you'll ever see. Because most of the time when you go into the neighborhoods, like I used to ride my bike up Grand Avenue to go to my buddy's Paul's house, right? And there's this park, and I can't remember the name of the park right now, but sitting in the middle of the park is a tank. Now, the next time the mayor comes out and starts talking about role models and violence in the neighborhood, how about we get the tank out of the park, right? You know, or the howitzers that litter park. I mean, it's just madness, right? But if you go to the monument in Washington, all it is names, and it's very moving. The one addition after there was some right-wing veterans kicked up a lot of dust and right-wing congressmen is they added sort of three soldiers off to the side. But it's a very moving monument, and I think reflects the fact that it should be really about what mourning is about, which is about grief and coming to terms with it, not celebrating mass slaughter. I think when it comes to Vietnam, the Americans, liberals who made up the people who first launched the war in Vietnam and later turned against it, always talked about Vietnam as a mistake or a tragedy, and that's how they explain away their deliberate attempt to destroy the people of Vietnam. This was no tragedy. It was no accident. It was deliberate policy. The Vietnamese always saw it as part of their struggle against foreign domination, and always supported Americans who supported them. So very early on in the war, the Vietnamese knew that the American people would turn against the Vietnam War eventually. They knew quite a lot about the United States and its history. After all, they identified with the American struggle against Great Britain, and they identified with the American Civil Rights Movement. So one of the things that happened early in the war is that there was an American pacifist named Norman Morrison, who, emulating Buddhist monks in Vietnam who were opposing the American dictatorship there, they would set themselves on fire to demonstrate their opposition to the government. This is what the Buddhist monks did. And it went worldwide. It just horrified people. It was a traditional practice, but it horrified people because it exposed the dirty secret about what the Americans were doing in Vietnam. After all, people are willing to do something like that to demonstrate how unjust something is. It must be pretty unjust. And in the United States, there was an American pacifist named Norman Morrison who did the same thing outside the Pentagon, in fact, outside of Robert McNamara's office in 1966. And the Vietnamese, the North Vietnamese, built a monument and a museum to Norman Morrison, which exists to this very day. And there were several things like that done. I think that, you know, there's a kind of weird thing, a fascination with the Vietnam War that exists partly because it's true in terms of the 1960s. People think they know the history when really what they're taught is something that's completely different from what actually happened, or is so distorted that once they learn it, they go, well, hold it, I was taught this in school. So there's this kind of fascination. Like if you go down to like Borders bookstore and you'll find one copy of my book in Borders, okay, that's my gripe. You'll find tons of other books on Vietnam, and they're all about weapons and guns and really bad spy stuff, like I'm in G47 and this is what we did behind enemy lines, right? And it's like turning it into an adventure story, right? And I think that, you know, all that really is a way of doing is kind of not only glamorizing, you know, the special forces or the Green Berets that were in Vietnam, which is nothing to glorify, I'll tell you. But it's also a way of, again, not trying to come to terms with the most basic, simple things about the Vietnam War. Is why did the Vietnamese fight the greatest power in the world, and how could they defeat them? And that's the big thing about Vietnam. So they spend a lot of time rewriting history and distorting it because it serves a purpose of laying the groundwork for the next awful imperial adventure that this government does. They spent 15 years trying to undo the Vietnam War so they could launch a war in Iraq and look at the disastrous consequences with that.
I was just wondering how you feel confident about your sources, just because I'm always conflicted, just, you know, like what you said, what we learn in school isn't the way it is, and you can't trust news necessarily, and I never know, you know, I don't particularly want to go in depth about what's going on in Iraq, but I'd like to have reliable information, and I have no idea how to go about looking for that and finding that, whether it's the war or anything else going on.
You mentioned that in college you took a course solely dedicated to Vietnam, and I'm just wondering, I want to know your aspect as helps to how your views changed as a kid with the war fresh in your mind versus when you finally took the class in college.
One of the things I do in the back is I give a list of recommended books I give, because I think one of the things is I haven't, you know, there's lots of good books that were written on Vietnam, but they were written a while ago. They were written by people who were either active participants of the anti-war movement or they were scholars who wanted to discover the real history of the Vietnam War and the American role in it. So there's very good histories out there that have been written, but they haven't been written recently with an eye towards what's been going on today. And they're, you know, and they all have something that's missing to them. I mean, my feeling is that even with the best of the histories, with the exception of one or two, the Vietnamese don't play the role in it that they should. I mean, after all, the Vietnamese call it the American War. That's how they teach it, because in a sense it was, right? The other is that, you know, one of the great sources for material on the Vietnam War is actually the U.S. government itself, particularly its criminal behavior, because in 1971 there was a scandal that people may have a small memory of, and it's referred to as the Pentagon Papers. And Robert McNamara, who launched the war in Vietnam with Lyndon Johnson, was Secretary of Defense. He was the longest-serving Secretary of Defense in American history, but, you know, he commissioned a study of the war. How did the Americans get involved in the war and what decisions were made in late 1967 when he was on his way out? It was a secret history. It was not supposed to be made public. And one of the people who worked on the study was a man named Daniel Ellsberg and another man named Tony Russo. And what they did is that after being influenced by the big movement against the war, they realized that this history, which is, you know, not complete or anything, but it really tells the real side of the story that had been suppressed by their own historians in the Pentagon. And they released it in 1971. And Richard Nixon went to the Supreme Court to try to make sure that this history was suppressed and to stop the newspapers from publishing it because they said it was state secrets. In fact, what it really was just a history, but it was an explosive history because it went through a lot of the stuff that I mentioned here today. And so the Pentagon Papers themselves is actually a very important source of information on this. My views as a kid as opposed to going to school, I think that I was lucky. And well, you know, I mean, the Vietnam War had a very big impact on my family in a way that it did for millions of other people. My mother's brother, my uncle, fought in the Vietnam War. He was a little older, you see, and there was a big generational split inside the military. If people can see a documentary called Sir No Sir that came out a few years ago, it will blow you away. Once you see it, you'll look at the world in a very different way. And what it is that it's a history of the opposition to the Vietnam War from inside and by American soldiers and sailors and airmen. And it just tells you how really the war came to an end, which is that soldiers stopped refusing to fight it. H.R. Haldeman, who was Richard Nixon's chief of staff, was asked in the early 1970s, you know, why aren't you pursuing a more aggressive war in Vietnam? And he simply said, well, if the troops are going to mutiny, you can't really follow an aggressive policy. But that is only one little statement about a huge movement against the war that existed inside the military, particularly among younger GIs, particularly spearheaded by black soldiers and sailors. You know, you'll never be told, but, you know, in 1972, it was particularly under the leadership of black sailors that two aircraft carriers that were going to be sent to carry out huge bombings of Vietnam at sort of the last birth of death by the United States government. It was because black sailors in particular refused to go that those ships never sailed. I mean, and this is a whole hidden history of the war that's very important. In my family, you know, you had my uncle who was a little bit older, so he was sort of more conservative in his views about the war, but I had cousins who were very active in the anti-war movement in the general atmosphere of things of the time, you know. And it's also important to get a sense of an era of politics, because if you go from the Montgomery bus boycott to, say, the resignation of Richard Nixon from office in August 1974, is that you have 20 years in which tens of millions of people, black, white, Latino, men and women, gay and straight, rose up and came to political consciousness. Vietnam kind of brought that political consciousness to the sort of height of its highest level. So that in 1971, when, you know, a survey was taken of college students, this is done by Time magazine, over 1 million college students considered themselves to be revolutionaries. That is, they wanted a radical restructuring of American society, which is also why, particularly on the college campuses from really the mid-70s to this day, they've made such a huge effort to make them once again the province simply of the wealthy, that ideas that are, you know, left of liberals are not present. That's why there was this sort of 10-15 year attack on what the right wing called politically correct. People have probably heard that phrase. But what that really means is an attack on educators who wanted to talk about racism and sexism and homophobia in the schools. They wanted to turn the colleges back to what they were, which was conservative institutions in many ways. And I think that, you know, but to this very day, there's echoes of Vietnam that continue, you know, in many ways that are unconscious, that people are unconscious about. I mean, the fact that, you know, there is no draft in this country is because of the legacy of the Vietnam War. You know, in the late 1960s and early 1970s, they were drafting, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of young men to fight in Vietnam who were already radicalized and opposed to the war in some way in this country. People probably don't know that one of the hidden aspects, you know, people talked about how in 1968 there was a big, you know, violence against anti-war demonstrators here in Chicago. A week beforehand, it was predominantly black army soldiers down in Fort Hood, Texas, refused to go to Chicago because they said, we're not going to be used to crush anti-war demonstrations or to be used to commit violence in the black neighborhoods of Chicago. So there's a whole layer of deep radicalization and political consciousness that had to be suppressed, sometimes violently, sometimes through corruption, sometimes just through rewriting history in order to maintain and get what they hoped was the United States back to its predominant power in the world. And it did that, and we now have the disasters in Iraq and Afghanistan.
So you have this chapter 4, about black American Vietnam, and you've spoken a lot about their involvement in anti-war protests. Can you say something about Latinos?
Yeah, I was just going to say also around the mythology of the Vietnam War and just the 60s in general. I mean, I always liked the idea of the 60s because I was like, oh, you know, there was a peace movement and flower children and great music and all that stuff. But it's depoliticized too. It's like we don't really talk about the politics of it. Like, why was it that the U.S. went in there, let alone like all the history that Joe is talking about. And I feel like it's also necessary because what Vietnam exposes is that we actually have a role to play in the way that history goes. Just in terms of what it means for us today, I think that's a valuable lesson. Like, it's not that it doesn't matter what we think about the war. It does matter. And when we get active around it, we can actually, you know, ordinary people are the ones that change the course of history. And I think that's an important lesson.
Well, you know, I think that when you talk about the impact of the war and how it brought political consciousness to a lot of people is that that's particularly true of Latinos. Now, when you say Latino, that the only thing that really means in most cases is that people speak Spanish or may speak Spanish. That when you address, you know, different groups of people from Latino backgrounds, is that they have very different experiences in the United States. But two groups of people that had very similar experiences with the Vietnam War was Puerto Ricans in Puerto Rico and the United States and Mexican Americans, and they made up really quite as much as African Americans did. They served and were drafted in larger numbers than they represented in the population. And they also came from the poorest section of working class people, particularly Puerto Ricans who emigrated to New York. You know, Puerto Rico is one of the great anomalies of the Vietnam War. There was many things during the war that radicalized or politicized people. One of the reasons that the voting age was dropped to 18, which was only valid until starting with the 1972 election, is because for the bulk of the Vietnam War, you could be drafted if you were under 21, but you couldn't vote in any election. So you can go die, you can't drink beer, and you can't vote for president, but you can die in Vietnam. And that kind of was, for most young men, a problem. I would have that, you know. And in Puerto Rico, you have an even more absurd thing, which is that Puerto Ricans are considered U.S. citizens, but they actually can't vote for president. And the president's the one who drafts you and sends you to war, which leads to a lot of different debates about Puerto Rican politics and what Puerto Rico should be. Should it be an independent country or a state? And these are big, big issues among Puerto Ricans. Of course, in the United States, where a lot of Puerto Ricans emigrated following the Second World War, they emigrated like any group before that, but in large numbers after the Second World War, many settled in the greater New York area and really were just drafted in incredibly disproportionate numbers. Puerto Rico itself had one of the highest casualty rates in the war. More people from Puerto Rico died in the war than did, say, from the state of Maine. And everybody in Maine can actually vote for president. Mexican Americans, who during the 60s, many people referred to themselves as Chicano, it's a term that's not used as much these days, but then it was much more used by particularly political activists. In 1971, there was the Chicano National Moratorium against the war. Now, a moratorium is a term which just simply means this is the day when we stop participating in the war. And it was modeled on moratoriums that had taken place previously nationwide. And there was a demonstration in Los Angeles. Now, Los Angeles is always portrayed as a nice land of sunshine and vacations and a liberal city. And the thing you should always remember about L.A. is that it always was a violent sweatshop hellhole for most people who went there, and particularly for Mexican Americans. It's true for African Americans who went to L.A., but particularly true for Mexican Americans. There was a very large demonstration, 40, 50,000 Mexican Americans against the war, which was viciously attacked by the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department, Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. Many people were seriously injured. In fact, Ruben Salazar, who people would not recognize that name today, was an investigative reporter, one of the few investigative reporters who was of Mexican ancestry for Los Angeles television stations. He, in fact, made a sort of mission of himself of his reporting to investigate police brutality, was actually murdered by the L.A. County Sheriff's Department during the Chicano moratorium. He was in a restaurant, and they surrounded it, and they shot a tear gas canister through the window, hitting him in the head and killing him. But that led to a real political awakening among Mexican Americans, in particular in the Southwest and in California. And a very powerful movement arose over the issues, very similar to African Americans, but with a little bit of a difference on the issue of bilingual education and language rights and how history is taught among Mexican Americans. In most public schools, for example, in the southwestern United States, that includes Texas, is that, you know, you would be beaten by teachers right through the 1960s if you spoke Spanish to a friend. in class. I mean, you know, and these are in public schools. This is not, you know, the hellhole of Catholic schools. I mean, we're talking about, you know, these are public schools at the time. And I think that, you know, part of what the Chicano moratorium represented was how millions of, you know, working class people became opposed to the war in Vietnam. You know, one of the great myths about the 1960s, and there's many of them, that you have to sort of wade through sometimes, is that, you know, there was this thing for years where right-wingers and, you know, virtually the entire political establishment used to talk about this idea that soldiers were spit upon by anti-war activists, right? That when they came home, activists called them baby killers, spit on them, treated soldiers and sailors badly. It didn't happen. It's a totally manufactured myth. There's no documented example of that ever happening. In fact, quite the opposite takes place in the late 1960s, which is soldiers and sailors are welcomed into the anti-war movement, so that actually it's anti-war veterans who actually become the leadership of the anti-war movement in the 1970s. The other closely related myth about the 1960s is that the richer you were, the more liberal you were, and the more likely you were to oppose the war in Vietnam, and the poorer you were, and the more working class you were, and particularly if you were white, you were supposed to be these kind of mad pro-war fanatics. And, of course, if you look at all the statistics from the late 70s, and from the early 70s and late 60s, the further you went up the income bracket, guess what? You supported the government policies. The further you went down the income bracket, you were more likely to oppose the government policies, because, after all, you were the ones being drafted to be sent to fight in the war itself. So I think, you know, when you go back and you look at the war in Vietnam, there's, you know, I wrote my book, you know, over the last couple of years, and there are many other books that were written beforehand that everybody should, everybody should have a good library of books. I mean, I know in the internet generation that it's hard to convince people to have your own personal libraries, but people need to read books. You need to learn history. People got to stretch their minds, you know, right now. One thing, for example, that Barack Obama is committed to is deepening the war in Afghanistan. People have probably never thought in their lives that they would actually have to go out and learn something about Afghanistan. And people really need to go learn what the real history of the West, whatever that is, and the United States. Well, they always call this thing the West. It's supposed to be this moral force in the world. It's like, I'm still trying to find it on the map. I keep spinning it around. Where's the West again? And people just need to learn about these things, and they need to learn about history, because, you know, the past is never dead. There's a reason why, you know, the government and the right wing in particular are always, you know, very determined to hang on to what is taught in schools. Because what's taught in schools is important about implementing policies today. And when you learn something about the past, it also should give you a critical eye on what's being done today. There are many parallels between the war in Vietnam and what's going on in the Middle East, but they are, at the end of the day, two very different types of wars with very different political components to them. But when you read about the history of Vietnam, though, you'll be drawn to the parallels, and it give you some idea of then how you have to respond to it, because, after all, not only are the lives of millions of people at stake in that part of the world, but also the quality of our lives and our brothers and sisters who are in uniform are also at stake over these sort of mad policies. So, you know, maybe one of the things you guys can do is draw up a petition to get, you know, a history course taught in this school on Iraq and Vietnam. Students have to start demanding that history be taught in the right way. You know, one of the big important events, political movements of the late 60s and early 70s, is when black students particularly took the lead in demanding that there would be black studies programs. They didn't exist before. There weren't Chicano studies programs. There weren't women's studies programs, you know. I mean, history was taught in an extremely narrow, chauvinist, nationalistic way. I mean, if you looked at some of the textbooks from those eras, you would just be like, oh, my God. So, you know, students need to stand up and be active not only about foreign policy, but also what they're being taught in the schools these days. Because, after all, people's lives are at stake. And learning from Vietnam is an important part of making sure we get a better future and we don't recycle the past.
That was Joe Allen on Vietnam. This classic from the AR Archives was recorded in Chicago. Joe Allen is a contributor to the International Socialist Review and the author of Vietnam, The Last War the U.S. Lost. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization, Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Glenn Greenwald, Nancy McLean, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Michael Parenti, Angela Davis, Chris Hedges, Vandana Shiva, and Naomi Klein. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.